Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The world of Cleopatra the VII, the last great pharaoh before Egypt succumbed to Roman opposition, lived from 69 to 30 BC, and it was a rule that has been thought about. There have been so many movies about Cleopatra. It was marked with political intrigue and challenges to the throne. She captivated, as you know, two of the most powerful men of the day, Julius Caesar and Mark Antony, as she attempted to restore Egypt to its former superpower status. And she was something. She was incredibly learned. She spoke seven languages. And there is an exhibit that's on right now at the Milwaukee Public Museum, The World of Cleopatra the VII. It was lost to the sea and sand for nearly 2,000 years, and due to some great archaeology work, which we'll hear about during the course of this hour, they have found some artifacts from her time and earlier. And so now there's an exhibit, Cleopatra, The Search for the Last Queen of Egypt, which is on right now and continues until April 29 at the Milwaukee Public Museum, featuring nearly 150 artifacts from Cleopatra's time. And we are, this hour of the program, going to be speaking with an archaeologist who's department head and curator of ancient history at the Milwaukee Public Museum. He is vice president for museum programs and has been an archaeologist with the museum since 1976. Carter Lupton is our guest. Carter is participated in major excavations all over the world, Illinois, France. He was in Syria at the site of a Bronze Age city on the Euphrates River. He's been connected with an American expedition in Egypt, a major center of pre-dynastic development. He's been heavily involved in technical studies on Egyptian mummies and was project director for Temples, Tells, and Tombs, a major Milwaukee exhibition on ancient Near Eastern and classical civilizations. He leads Smithsonian journeys to Greece, Israel, Jordan, Egypt, and Mexico. And he's our guest this hour, and we'll be welcoming phone calls. Some of you, the exhibit just opened recently, but some of you have seen it, I'm sure, or some of you have questions about Cleopatra and archaeology. Feel free to use our phone lines. It's 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Chrissy and Rhonda and I had a chance to see the exhibit and enjoyed it thoroughly last week. Carter, hello. Thanks very much for being with us.
Good morning, Kathleen. Great to be here.
Yeah, we really enjoyed the exhibit. It's very, very well done. Let me start by asking why Cleopatra is so endlessly, endlessly fascinating.
Well, I think partly because she's a woman from the ancient world. There have been a lot of men who have accomplished as much or more, but that's sort of standard, you know. For a woman to have accomplished what she did, to have led a major country, to have literally come within inches, I think, of reasserting Egypt, or asserting Egypt as one of the most powerful countries in all of the ancient world and a true rival to Rome. She came very close to doing that with Mark Antony's help. That's quite an accomplishment. But then, of course, there's the other aspect of her being a woman, that there's this romantic story to be told constantly over and over again. And it can be tied in, and it has been for 2,000 years, into art, into literature, into drama, poetry, film, plays, you name it.
Yeah, you name it. She's been everywhere for a long time. The other thing that astounded me about the exhibit is that you couldn't have done this exhibit all that long ago. Most of these finds have been fairly recent, and they are enormous finds, aren't they?
Yes, they're really fantastic. The vast majority of this material has only resurfaced either from under the ocean or from the sands of Egypt in the last 10 to 15 years, some as little as less than 5 years ago.
So why was it found now? I would imagine people have been looking for it for a couple of thousand years, haven't they?
Well, a great deal of, you have to remember that Alexandria, one of the greatest cities by far of the ancient world, the ancient Mediterranean world, is buried under modern Alexandria, for one thing, which is still the second largest city in Egypt of several million people. So there's this massive modern metropolis overlying much of it, and so you just can't get at it. The stuff that has surfaced, and most of what this exhibit deals with, is material that was underwater, that's actually under the ocean in Alexandria Harbor. due to land subsidence silting up over the years from the Nile, and of course large earthquakes and tsunamis that have toppled buildings that have been toppled into the harbor and been buried underwater. Now, this kind of diving, scuba diving, has only been around 50 or 60 years, since the 40s, so it's not like that goes back to the early days of archaeology. Alexandria Harbor is still a very, very busy harbor. If you look at slides of it, there are fishing boats and commercial ships out there all the time. So just finding a plan and a place to dive and then start to recover some of this large material takes a lot of time. So it's not something that could have happened even 20 or 30 years ago, I don't think.
I was amazed to look at some of these statues are huge that were found in this area underwater. They were remarkably well preserved for being underwater for a couple thousand years, weren't they?
Right. Well, a lot of it, of course, is very hard stones, granites and granodiorites, that are not going to be bothered too much by the salt water. Some of the materials, besides the stone, a lot of the statues, of course, are that hard stone. We have metallic objects. We have pottery objects. We have various other objects, gold and what name it. You name it. But the stone is, I think if a lot of this had been limestone, it's possible some limestone and things were buried in there, they just aren't preserved as well, you know, as say, these granite statues, which really are, you know, incredibly dense and strong and are going to not succumb to water action or weed actions, seaweed and algae and whatnot.
You get the feeling, seeing the exhibit, that Alexandria was a pretty sophisticated and beautiful place when she reigned, was it?
It was by far the leading city in the ancient Mediterranean world. At the time that Julius Caesar and then Mark Antony from Rome first came to Alexandria, it would have been somewhat like people from, Green Bay maybe, coming to New York City. Hmm. Alexandria was far and away a more splendid and a more sophisticated and a more cosmopolitan city than Rome was at this time.
And who was responsible for that?
For them coming to Rome? To Alexandria?
No, for building it.
Well, the city was founded by Alexander the Great, hence its name. That was in 332 BC when he was leaving Macedon, northern Greece, basically fighting the Persians who had taken over most of the Mediterranean and Eastern Mediterranean world. He was reconquering the Persian Empire for Greece. And unfortunately, he died without a son and heir. And his kingdom was divided up amongst his generals. And the area that today is Egypt was taken by his general Ptolemy, who eventually became the king of a new dynasty. He was Ptolemy the First. In about 305 BC, he became king. He began building Alexandria, which Alexander had founded the spot, but he had not lived to see it built as a city. He simply had said, this is where I want this city, on the Mediterranean. Ptolemy I, and then later his son Ptolemy II, really get the credit for building this massive city and getting it on its getting it going.
And she was of the Ptolemy lineage?
Yes, she was in the Ptolemaic dynasty. She was the last of the Ptolemaic rulers, a 300-year-long dynasty.
But she was of Greek descent?
She's a Greek Macedonian descent, as were all of the Ptolemies. Yes, they were not native Egyptians. They had come from a different place. Now, some people will call her Greek. Technically, she's not Greek. She's Macedonian Greek, which is north of Greece proper. She did not live in Greece or was not born in Greece. She was born in Egypt, of course, lived in Egypt her entire life, but she was not ethnically an Egyptian.
Mm-hmm. And she wasn't the first. We tend to think of Cleopatra, and there's one Cleopatra. She was not the first Cleopatra.
No, she's usually called Cleopatra the Seventh. She's the only one that reigned exclusively as a queen who had more power than any of her consorts, whether it was her brother. A lot of the Ptolemies had brother-sister marriage. What they felt, was an adoption of an ancient Egyptian custom, and it was done in ancient Egypt before their time, but not on the scale that it was done in Ptolemaic times. And partly to keep their bloodline pure. They knew they were outsiders and were not native Egyptians, and they wanted to keep their bloodline pure, so they frequently had brother-sister marriages. So there are many Cleopatras before Cleopatra the Seventh, but they are usually the wives of reigning Ptolemies. Hmm. She was the predominant partner throughout her life.
Mm-hmm. And she was so smart, wasn't she? I'm amazed. She spoke seven languages?
Well, Plutarch says she spoke seven, but he's not counting Greek and Egyptian. He's counting other languages.
Gosh.
So she actually spoke at least nine. We don't know if she spoke Latin, because most of the Romans she would have come in contact with could have spoken Greek, which she was very good at, which was the lingua franca of Egypt at this time, but she could speak ancient Egyptian, which no other Ptolemy before her could do. So it was just amazing. Yes, she was very, very well educated.
Where did she go to school?
In Alexandria. As I said, Alexandria was one of the most cosmopolitan intellectual cities of the world. They had the great museion, from which we get the word museum, a learning center, essentially a center for scholars, for debate and for teaching and learning. So many of the great scholars, even if you look at great scholars from the classical world that we think of with Greek names like Eratosthenes, and this, actually lived and studied in Alexandria, many of them.
And from the recent finds, Carter, what have we been able to learn about Alexandria and to learn about her in particular? What myths have been shattered? What's the truth about the time now that we know?
Well, we know that she, as we say, was queen of a major country, an important country, the wealthiest country in the world at the time, which is one reason, strangely enough, as wealthy as it was, the reason Egypt got involved with Rome to begin with, and this was before Cleopatra's time, in her father's time, and even before his time, several generations. The Egyptian later Ptolemies were getting involved with the Romans for a variety of reasons, sometimes needing money, sometimes needing other things. And it's kind of funny to think, well, they needed money from the Romans, which they did borrow, and then the Romans came to get those debts paid back. And yet later on, Mark Antony, for example, the reason he got involved with Cleopatra was he needed money. He wanted to mount a large campaign against the Parthians, who lived in what is northern Iran today. And he needed money to do it. He knew Cleopatra had more money than anybody else. So it wasn't just what you see in the movies. He thought she was just the most gorgeous woman that ever lived, and wow, this is really going to do it. He had very practical political reasons for getting involved with her and her country.
But was she gorgeous?
Well, that's a good question. Everybody wants to know what she looked like.
Right, I know.
The only depictions for sure that we know represent her are on her coins. There are many, many coins from her time, and they have an image, profile image of a woman. Usually, if you look at them closely, they have sort of a large nose, a bit of a strong chin. They look even a bit masculine. Some people say that's a conscious attempt, maybe, to look more masculine, because these are coins that people are going to carry around with them, and their ruler... You know, they're not used to having a woman ruler. They're used to male rulers, so maybe she wanted to just, you know, play that part a little more. We don't know. They're not the most flattering, but then no ancient coin portraits are flattering, whether it's Julius Caesar or Mark Antony or anybody. Their coin portraits are not as good as their busts. Now, there are several busts from Rome done in the classical style that people will say, this is Cleopatra, but in fact, we don't have an inscription on them. We don't know that it's Cleopatra. They're assumed to be Cleopatra based on their similarity in basic style, hairdo, etc., to the coins. And then now there are some other Egyptian-style statues that are assumed to be Cleopatra based on other features that are really stylistic features. So we just don't know exactly what she looked like. We think we know sort of. We have some ancient Roman writings about her, but again, all the Roman writings about her were written after her death. Mm-hmm. So the people that are writing are not people who saw her themselves. Some will say she's absolutely gorgeous. Others will say, well, she was not the most incomparable woman that ever lived, but she was unbelievably intelligent and charming and had a voice that could just about charm anyone. Mm-hmm. So this
and
is
powerful.
What enraptured people was being in her presence and talking with her personality.
Yeah. And it's interesting that you have her, as you do the audio tour through the exhibit, you have her tell the story.
Telling her own story, yes.
Yeah. There's also, how real is this? Is it indeed her handwriting on one of those pieces of papyrus?
Well, that isn't really certain. The person that published that papyrus back, I think it was in the year 2000, believed it. And there are other scholars who have supported that. There is this papyrus that basically gives some tax breaks to another Roman who was a friend of Mark Antony's, and we know it's dated to 33 BC, so it's from the time when she was alive and ruling Egypt. The last line is written in a different handwriting, and it says, it's got the word Genestha, and that means let it be done or make it so, make it happen. Did she write it with her own hand? Possibly, but we can't really prove that because we have no other known example of her handwriting. But it's certainly her order. She ordered it to be approved. Whether a scribe wrote that or she wrote it, we just can't be certain.
Mm-hmm. I know that there are digs going on right now. Tell me about those. There is a search for her tomb and Mark Antony's tomb as well. And the archaeologists believe that they are fairly close to finding it.
Well, that's a second part of the exhibit, which is different than the underwater archaeology. That's being done by Zahi Was, former head of the Supreme Council of Antiquities, and a female archaeologist from the Dominican Republic, who came up with this idea that she might be buried at a site called Taposiris Magna, which is about 18, 20 miles away from Alexandria, but along the coast. There's a large temple to the god Osiris there. And there are, certainly, it's from Ptolemaic times. It's from her time period. And they have been doing archaeology there for three or four seasons, I believe, looking for her tomb. Whether they will find it there, I just guess there's no way to know until you do find it or don't find it.
And do we indeed know that she poisoned herself?
Well, it is pretty certain that she committed suicide. Now, of course, the famous story is that she did it with a snake, a poisonous snake.
Yes.
And that's been a popular story in virtually every version of her story. In almost any painting that deals with her death shows her with a snake. Usually it's a relatively small snake. We do know, based on the descriptions from the time, that if she was poisoned by a snake, it almost would have had to have been an Egyptian cobra, a rather large snake, because that's the only kind that inflicts a bite that does not swell up and bruise and discolor the skin. Mm. And there's no mention of her having that situation. It's possible she took snake venom or some other type of poison and pricked her skin and poisoned herself that way. We just don't know. There's no eyewitness accounts to her actual death.
Yeah. But somewhere I read, or was this in a dream, that she knew a whole lot about poisons, and she had written a book about poisons. Is that right?
Well, she's been credited with writing several things in antiquity, but again, nobody knows for sure if she wrote them or if she's the one. Cleopatra is a Greek name, and it's a fairly common name. Besides the seven Cleopatras that were queens of Ptolemaic Egypt, there were many other women in the line and in sidelines of this whole family, and even going back to Macedonian Greece, that are named Cleopatra. So when something says it was written by Cleopatra, isn't necessarily Cleopatra the Seventh. We don't always know. But she is credited with writing things on cosmetics, on poisons, and all these things, and that she had studied these things. There are stories that she studied poisons and tested poisons on condemned prisoners in planning for her own suicide.
Oh,
what poisons would be the least painful, would simply put you to sleep until you drifted off nowhere, rather than make you writhe in agony.
Huh.
But we just don't know. These are stories.
Yeah. Somebody ought to find the book or the writing she did on cosmetics. You could make yourself a cool million, couldn't you?
I think
Cleopatra
so, yeah.
On cosmetics, how to be beautiful. How to keep the legend alive for 2,000 years.
Well, the movies and the paintings have done that, I think.
Yeah, you're right. Do you have a favorite movie? Do you like Liz?
I guess I like it better than some. You know, when it came out, it had so much controversy over Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton.
Right.
And I remember, I was just young at the time, and I remember even before the movie came out, Elizabeth Taylor had caught pneumonia, I believe, and she had to have an emergency tracheotomy to save her life. I remember that. And that was before Richard Burton was even attached. So it just had all kinds of controversy attached to this movie, and it cost so much money. So it's often considered this dismal failure. I don't think it's a failure, but it's not the greatest movie ever made. It's an interesting movie. There have been other interesting films. I kind of like all of them in one way, because they all give these different interpretations. And when you don't know a definitive answer one way or another, I think it's interesting to see different ways of looking at a person.
Right. Well, let's welcome phone calls. We'll take them in just a moment. Our guest this hour is Carter Lupton, Vice President for Museum Programs for the Milwaukee Public Museum. He's an archaeologist with the museum and has done digs all over the world, and he leads Smithsonian journeys to Greece, Israel, Jordan, Egypt, and Mexico. And he is our guest this hour to talk about Cleopatra, the search for the last queen of Egypt, which is now on at the Milwaukee Public Museum and will be until April 29. And it gives you a wonderful idea. It's a very, very nicely done exhibit in, I think, 8 different rooms. So it starts with a movie, and then it ends with the search for her tomb. So the excavations continue. But you get a good idea of who she was and the place over which she was the pharaoh. And it's quite a place, Alexandria. So feel free to join our conversation, would you? Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. There's also even a part of the exhibit that has some of the famous women who have portrayed Cleopatra on screen. So Liz Taylor is one of them, and there are others. We'll take your phone calls in a moment. I'm Kathleen Dunn, or the email is talk@wpr.org. Did I say that? You know, you say that so much, you forget if you've said it or if you haven't said it. So there I said it and said it again. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls now for Carter Lupton, and let's start with Alex in Shawano County. Hi, Alex.
Hello, this is Alexander from Shawano.
Hi.
Hi. Say, I'm a potter up here, and I'm very interested in those beautiful large amphora jars they used to transport wine and olive oil in the Mediterranean.
Mm-hmm.
This is earthenware terracotta pottery. How did they seal those jars? They didn't use glazes back then.
No. Honestly, to tell you the truth, I don't know. I don't work with classical pottery myself at all, so I'm not much of an expert on that technical aspect of it.
No one seems to know. Thank you.
Yeah, sorry.
All right, thanks for the call. Tell me about the process of caring for all of those things that are found, how you transport them from country to country, the care that you have to... I mean, there are videos, I know, of getting some of these very large statues from the bottom of the sea, and you're thinking, oh, I hope it makes it. I hope it makes it. You have to be extremely careful. And how careful do you have to be, and how do you preserve things that are thousands of years old?
Well, certainly you have to be careful, and especially with some of these things that are extremely heavy. Fortunately, some of them, when you're bringing them up from the water, they don't weigh as much till they get out of the water.
Right,
that's
yeah.
Only that last bit.
None of us do.
Using right. Cranes to get them up on the boats. There was actually a television show last year with Zahi Owas where one of these things, the large strap that they had around it attached to the crane, lifting this large stela out of the water, actually snapped or gave, and it fell back in the water, I believe.
Oh.
But that kind of thing happens. But you've got to be careful. You have very complex professional riggers who do this thing, move heavy objects for a living. And then you have engineers. For example, the giant statues, we have the two 17-foot granite statues, were transported here. It took us one full week, the first week, way back in late September, to just put those two statues up.
Really?
Get them transported into the museum, uncrated, up into our freight elevator, upstairs, and then erected, standing up. That was quite a project, a week-long
project.
They're
very dramatic. And an important part of the exhibit. What about all the coins, the jewelry, the utensils, etc.?
These all have to be cleaned with the appropriate solutions or physical cleaning, which isn't abrasive and doesn't rub them. Of course, fortunately, a lot of the coins, some of them are, I shouldn't say a lot, but some are gold. Gold doesn't tarnish too much, so that's not as difficult to clean. Bronze obviously tarnishes quite a bit, and you have to use special conservators who work on these, who clean these things, soak them in solutions, get rid of the bronze thing without obviously destroying the surfaces. So it's a very complex series of events, and it takes a long time. That's one reason you can't have these things on exhibit literally the minute they're found. You know, it takes time to prepare them for this kind of travel and exhibit.
Mm-hmm.
Special mounts have to be made, all kinds of things.
And what about the Milwaukee Public Museum? Did you have to do a presentation to somebody, and if so, whom, to get this exhibit here?
Well, the exhibit is put together by a company called AEI, American Exhibitions, and they contracted with the Egyptian government and with Frank Gaudio, the French underwater explorer who's found all this stuff, to assemble this material, put an exhibit and a concept together, and then that company works individually with the individual museums that are going to host such an exhibit. You develop contracts of what you're getting and how this is going to work and how that's going to work, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Steve in Madison next. Hi, Steve.
Good morning. Just want to say, first of all, I'm really looking forward to seeing this, but I had a question about the effects of the change in government in Egypt on mm-hmm. the archaeological things. I know
right.
I had looked at how Habizawas's website two or three weeks ago, and he was basically saying, you know, this is the end of archaeology.
Really?
And so I was wondering what your take was on that.
Well, I've worked in Egypt off and on for many, many years, and I have some sense of how it works over there. Now, he was in charge for a long, long time. He's been retired since the middle of July. In August, a new person was appointed, a person whom I actually personally knew well because he was my roommate on a dig 30 years ago. But he found that the complexities of working in the current situation in Egypt, where there's still a lot of sites out there that are not close to cities, they're hard to guard, and there was a lot of looting going on after the revolution back in January, February. He felt that the chaos and the demonstrations by young people about not getting enough jobs in the Antiquities Department was just too disruptive, and he left after about a month. He left in September. They've now just appointed last month a new head of the Antiquities Department. This man is an Islamicist. He's not a pharaonic scholar, and he's only had this job for about a month, so it's really too early to tell. But it does create problems. It creates a slowdown, and how it's all going to pan out. I don't think it's the end of archaeology in Egypt. I don't believe that at all. There are digs going on right now. I know there are. We have, as part of this project, an Egyptian who is always here at all times throughout the exhibit, and they work for the Antiquities Department in Egypt. We have one here right now, actually this Wednesday in 2 days. A new one is coming to be here for the next month when this one goes home, and that will continue throughout the run of this exhibit until April. So routine things are going on as usual, and things are being watched for. Actual digging, especially by Egyptians, may slow down a bit this year or the next year, but I know foreign digs are going on. They just started up about 2 or 3 weeks ago. So it's not the end of archaeology. Hopefully just a blip.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, thanks very much for the call, Steve. I'm glad you called with that question. And the visitors are doing what? Just over? Are they here to answer questions? Or the
They are here visitors? To oversee. They take readings. They double-check with all their, because they are responsible for all these objects, these 150 objects. They take readings. I mean, we take them as well, but they take their own readings of humidity and temperature every day. They take readings on the attendance each week of how the exhibit is doing. Has anything happened? Have there been any issues that they need to bring up to their superiors back in Egypt? So they send weekly reports.
What do you think, as you look at the exhibit and you're an archaeologist, are the biggest finds? What is the most dramatic about the exhibit?
Well, just the fact that all of this stuff was right there, as you said, for so long, right there in the harbor. You know, years ago, when I first went to Egypt and went to Alexandria for the first time, and this is over 30 years ago, it was basically thought that most of Alexandria would never be found simply because it was under this modern city, and nobody's going to tear down high-rise buildings, you know, apartment buildings and hotels and to get at ancient archaeology. There were a few. There's a Roman theater, for example, that's been excavated since the 60s, and it stands there, and you can see that it's below the modern ground level, but something had to be cleared away to find that, and they're not going to clear away major streets and major buildings to find all this stuff. So I kind of thought for many, many years, well, that's sort of it, you know? That's all we're ever going to see of ancient Alexandria. But now to find all this material, all this statuary and portions of buildings and structures out in the harbor that people really didn't think would be there or didn't look for, and to find that this is all out there now is quite exciting. Two other cities, you know, besides Alexandria, there are two other sites that are featured in this exhibit, Canopus and Heraklion, which are near Alexandria but separate, and they were also totally underwater. So that's sort of, to me, the most amazing thing.
Let's talk a little bit about Canopus. It was the religious center and also kind of this dual, you would think they would be at odds, religious center and a decadent playground.
Yes, well, they say it's sort of like the Las Vegas of ancient Egypt in a way. It was a little bit of both. And, you know, certainly particularly in some aspects of ancient religion, Mark Antony, for example, was very much considered himself connected somehow with the classical god Dionysus, the god of wine and revelry. So to have Dionysiac festivals or revelries is a religious rite, but it's also pretty wild by the modern standards of religion.
And was this the place that you took canals to? There were canals linking them, and you took boats to get there?
Well, there were some canals. Alexandria itself, for example, is on a spit of land, essentially, that faces the Mediterranean. But behind Alexandria, in the other direction, away from the Mediterranean, is this large inland lake, Lake Mareotis. One reason we think that Alexander chose this site to have his site, he wanted it to be outward-looking into the Mediterranean, into the world he was from, but it's also through the lake, inward-looking into the Nile and into Egypt itself.
Mm-hmm.
So up in the delta, there's a lot of branches of the Nile and canals and streamlets, you might call them. So that a lot of travel would have been by boat.
I see. Alan on the road. Hi, Alan.
Hi. I had a question about one of the pieces in the exhibit.
Mm-hmm.
I was there last Wednesday.
Okay.
It's announced that it was in the temple, I believe, at Heraklion. The top, it said, was from the Louvre. Was that really from the Louvre, or was that a replica?
That one is a replica. The original piece, that was the Naos of the Decades, is what you're talking about.
Right.
It's
exactly.
A Naos is a large granite, hard stone, not a basin, but a container that would hold the statue of a god inside a temple. And it has a peaked top. And that one, parts of it were found by Frank Gaudio underwater in Aboukir Bay. But other parts had been found years ago, decades ago, and was in the Louvre in Paris. So the parts that are from the Louvre are actually replicas. They were not removed from France for this exhibit.
Hmm.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks, Alan, very much for the call. Our number, by the way, if you'd like to join us, is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Cutter Lupton is with us to talk about the Cleopatra exhibit at the Milwaukee Public Museum on right now. He's vice president for museum programs for the museum. Carter, tell me about her children, the one she had with Julius Caesar and those she had with Mark Antony.
Mm-hmm. Cleopatra had four children during her lifetime. She had a son, usually in most books referred to as Caesarion, which means Little Caesar, and obviously it's generally believed that he was the son of Julius Caesar by Cleopatra. Now, Julius Caesar never officially acknowledged him as a son, but he never denied it either. And this son, when he was very young, 3 years old, he and Cleopatra went to Rome before Caesar's death in 44 BC. And so she had him in Rome, and he was known as Caesarion, and Julius Caesar did not go around saying, "This is not my son, this is not my son." He couldn't say, "This is my son," because it wouldn't have been legal anyway. By Roman law, he couldn't have had a legitimate child by a foreigner and by a woman who was not his wife, and he was married at the time. So there was no point in acknowledging him. It would have had no legal weight. But he certainly did not deny it. So it's generally believed that this was definitely his son. And he was the biggest threat after Caesar's death to Cleopatra. Caesar's true heir, the one he made his heir in his will, was Octavian, who became the first emperor Augustus several years later. He was really Caesar's nephew, but he made him his son and heir in his will. He would not have wanted a biological son of Caesar around, and so when he finally did overthrow Mark Antony and Cleopatra in 30 BC, one of the first things he did was assassinate Caesarion. Now, Cleopatra also had three children by Mark Antony. She had a set of twins, a boy and a girl, and then later had another son. Those three children all outlived their mother, and they were actually taken back to Rome and supposedly raised, believe it or not, by Octavian's sister, Octavia.
Really?
Who had been Mark Antony's wife before he got involved with Cleopatra.
Oh, my goodness.
So, it was a very interesting situation. We don't really know after 29 BC when they were shown in triumph back in Rome when Octavian was celebrating his triumph over Egypt. The two young boys were shown, but we never hear much of them again. But the girl, the daughter, whose name was Cleopatra Selene, grew up in Rome, was betrothed to another young man named Juba II, who was the son of another Roman client king from North Africa, who was made the king of Mauritania, not modern Mauritania, but what today would be Algeria. And he married Cleopatra Selene, Mark Antony and Cleopatra's daughter. They had a son, which would now be Mark Antony and Cleopatra's grandson. When he reached maturity in the first century AD, he was eventually murdered, believe it or not, by the emperor Caligula. who was a descendant of Mark Antony himself.
Mm-hmm.
So Caligula was his cousin. So the last of Cleopatra's line, her grandson by Mark Antony, was killed by his own cousin, the Emperor Caligula.
Oh, you know your ancient history here, Carter. I'm impressed.
It's a fascinating story.
It is fascinating. And what is exactly the link? Why do we say cesarean birth? Must have something to do with cesarean, doesn't it?
Yes. I don't know if it was Caesar himself, but had to be born that way, and so it became cesarean birth. I don't know if it was this Caesar or... Because every emperor after Augustus was Octavian, and when Julius Caesar died, Julius Caesar was not an emperor, by the way. He was a dictator. Augustus became the first true emperor of Rome. He took the name Augustus Caesar, actually Gaius Julius Caesar, Augustus, et cetera, et cetera. So he was frequently called Caesar in his own lifetime. And then, of course, all the emperors were called Caesars. So Caesar becomes sort of a generic term. And it's actually where we get the name Kaiser for the Germans, Tsar for the Russians, all comes from Caesar.
We're going to take more phone calls if you'd like to join our conversation. Carter Lupton is our guest. We're talking about Cleopatra, the search for the last queen of Egypt, which is now at the Milwaukee Public Museum and will be there until April 29. There are a number of different galleries. There's a movie that opens the exhibit, and then there are, let's see, 8 different galleries. It's very nicely done, and... for those of you who have seen it, we'd love to hear what you thought about it. If you have questions about Cleopatra, why we remember her as vividly as we do, and this great archaeological find within the last, what did Carter say, 10 to 15 years, they have found at the bottom of the sea and under the sand, just incredible number of artifacts that are from this time period, so we can learn more about and structure the city of Alexandria and also learn more about this very, very memorable queen. All right. More phone calls and a conversation in a moment. 800-486-8655 is the number. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Cleopatra is what we're talking about this hour, the last great pharaoh before Egypt succumbed to Roman opposition. She lived from 69 to 30 BC, and her reign is the focus of a lovely exhibit at the Milwaukee Public Museum, Cleopatra, the Search for the Last Queen of Egypt. 800-486-8655 is our number. And our guest is Carter Lupton, and he is the Vice President of Programs, Exhibits, and also an archaeologist and department head and curator of ancient history at the Milwaukee Public Museum. What do we know from historical record about what kind of pharaoh Cleopatra was, what she emphasized, how she ruled, how people thought of her, Carter?
Well, we don't know too much about what the Egyptians thought of her. Unfortunately, all of the written records that we have about Cleopatra come from the Romans, and they weren't usually on her side. So most of the pictures are anywhere from mediocre to downright negative. Some will praise her beauty or her wit and intelligence, but they'll say, but she used that to beguile men like Julius Caesar and Mark Antony. She had to be a very astute leader and ruler. You know, some people say, well, but look, she killed all of her relatives, her sisters and her brothers. Well, that's true, but that was a pretty common practice in her day, and not just in Egypt. In Ptolemaic Egypt, it happened all the time, but it was also happening in Rome. That's how you got rid of political enemies. And as somebody said not too long ago, they said, if she hadn't killed them, they would have killed her, and she wouldn't have lived long enough to have a story to tell these days. So she was simply doing what she needed to do to protect her own interests. And I do think she had the best interests of Egypt at heart. As I said, she was very much into Egyptian religion. She identified herself with the goddess Isis, an Egyptian goddess, very much. She could speak the ancient Egyptian language, which none of her predecessors had been able to do. So she was very much connected to the Egyptian culture and the Egyptian way of life, more so than many other Ptolemies were. She did things that we think of as very modern. For example, let's look at the economy. She minted coins
that actually had denominations printed on them. In ancient times, most coins were minted based on their weight. So a bronze coin of a certain weight had a certain value, and if a bronze coin of twice that weight had twice that value.
Hmm.
She didn't have that much in terms of precious metals available at her disposal. She didn't mint very many gold coins in her time. She sort of brought back bronze as a coinage, which has somewhat fallen out of favor. And she came up with coins that, just based on the stamp that was on them, sort of like we do with bills today. You know, a $1 bill and a $5 bill are the same size, and they have this, they have different pictures on them, but basically the real difference between them is the denomination. Is it $1, is it $5, is it $20? She made two coins that look absolutely identical, except one is stamped with a pi, the Greek letter pi, and that represents 80 drachmas. Another one is stamped with muan, the Greek letter m, and that's worth half that value, 40 muans. But the coins, except for that stamp, look identical. This was a new thing to the ancient people. These coins are exactly alike. Why are they worth the same value? Because that's what it says on the coin.
Mm-hmm.
That way she could make her limited resources stretch further and to her advantage, to the government's advantage. So she was thinking about these kinds of things. She was she introduced Julius Caesar, for example, to the Egyptian calendar. When he came to Rome, to Egypt, sorry, Rome was still following a lunar calendar. And a lunar calendar only has 354, 355 days. Because it doesn't follow a solar cycle. The Egyptians were using a solar calendar of 365 days. He, when he came back to Rome, introduced the solar calendar to Rome, and because he was basically the most powerful man in Rome and the Pontifex Maximus, he enforced the adoption of that calendar, because the lunar calendar in Rome was always getting so far off of what the real seasons were. And that's what we have today, essentially, the Julian calendar from Julius Caesar, but he got it from the Egyptians.
Hmm, interesting. Ryan in Madison. Hi, Ryan.
Hello?
Yes,
Hello.
Go ahead, Ryan.
It's Brian.
Oh, Brian. Hi, Brian.
Okay. Professor, I answered a question about movies a moment ago. My question concerns recommendations for recent biographies.
Mm-hmm. There have been quite a number of them. The most famous one has been by Stacy Schiff, called Cleopatra, A Life. That was published in 2010, but there have actually been quite a number of biographies. Actually, I counted at least six that have appeared in the last 3 years, since 2008. Another good one besides Stacy Schiff's book is one called Cleopatra, A Biography, by a man named Dwayne Roller. There are books with titles like Cleopatra and Rome, Cleopatra and Egypt, Cleopatra and Antony, Antony and Cleopatra. You can look on Amazon.com and just find all kinds of titles that are all within the last 3 or 4 years.
Thanks, Brian, for the call. Dave in Escanaba. Hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
All right, Dave, how are you?
Good. I'm interested in if guest could get into some detail on the public meeting between Cleopatra and Mark Antony and the political insight that she used, the political genius, really, that she used to portray herself as the goddess of Isis, and the significance of that to the Egyptians, and her portrayal of Antony, and I believe it was Mars, when they met publicly,
in
and
Tarsus.
Then afterwards they took a tour down the Nile,
yep,
with all the pageantry.
Yeah.
Did you get into a little of that?
Well, yeah, let me clarify one thing. They did not tour down the Nile. She toured down the Nile with Julius Caesar, supposedly. But she did meet Antony in Tarsus. Now, originally, he summoned her. Tarsus is in modern-day Turkey. So she was still in Egypt. He was in Turkey. He actually had been on campaign with Octavian looking for the in pursuit of the men who had murdered Julius Caesar, Brutus, Cassius, and others, and had just defeated them. And so in 41 B.C., he was ready to, he wanted to launch this Parthian campaign, as I mentioned earlier, to invade Parthia and put a stop to this other growing empire of people that Rome saw as a big threat. He needed money to do that. Now, his ostensible reason for calling Cleopatra to Tarsus was that he felt she had to answer for dealing with people like Cassius, one of the murderers of Julius Caesar, had she helped him or had she not. And
at first she would not go. She kept delaying going, but she eventually did show up. And that's what you see in the movies, this huge, elaborate barge. Plutarch says it had silver oars and golden sails and incense wafting off over as they went up the Cydnus River into Tarsus in southern Turkey. So she was coming to his summons, but she quickly turned the tables on him, and he invited her to a banquet at his camp on land, and she said, no, come dine with me on my barge. And she threw this elaborate banquet where she was decked out as the goddess Isis. She got him to represent the god Mars, the god of warfare and fighting, and she sort of played into his obsession with being a He-Man. He felt he was a descendant of Hercules to begin with. So he had sort of grandiose dreams about himself, and she fed right into that. She could easily manipulate him, unlike she could not really do this with Julius Caesar, who had a little more on the ball. So she very quickly turned the tables, and paintings of this, even from the 19th century, show he's sort of coming onto her ship, and she's the one putting on the show, and she's the one sort of enmeshing him and getting what she wants out of him, getting his loyalty to her, even though he's the one who said, I insist you come and meet me.
Oh, fascinating. Thank you, Dave, very much for the call. Jerry in Milwaukee. Hi.
Good morning, Kathleen and guests.
Good morning.
It's a fascinating subject. You know, I'm calling because I was in Turkey about 12 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, I lost all my photos and the notes I took through the storm. Anyway, I remember taking a boat and on a river and to an area where, in fact, there was remnants of Cleopatra's spa. And I don't remember where I was. I don't remember the name of the thing. It was along the banks of the river,
mm-hmm.
and it was partially submerged. I was wondering if you had any information on that.
Not offhand. They do not, no. As I said to the previous caller, when she did go to Turkey, to what was ancient Tarsus, this was on the Cydnus River, CYDNUS. It's in southeastern Turkey, but I'm not familiar with what ruins might be there today.
Hmm. All right. And thank you very much, Jerry, for it sounds like an interesting trip. Back to the records. All the records come from Rome.
Mm-hmm.
What happened to all the Egyptian records?
Well, they could well have been destroyed. It's possible. You have to remember, first of all, so much is written on papyrus, despite Rome. You know, there are records, obviously. We have that one document that's actually depicted in the exhibit that we talked about earlier that maybe she signed and maybe she didn't. But that's an example of an Egyptian papyrus. A lot of ancient Egyptian records, so once they were outdated or had no use, ended up, this one was actually found as part of a mummy wrapping. That's what they did with a lot of papyrus back in those days. The Roman records were not just written on papyrus, they were written on other more permanent things. And then, of course, even the writings that would have been contemporary that were Roman, we don't have. As I said, all the Roman accounts we have of Cleopatra date to anywhere from half a century or three quarters of a century to 2 and 3 centuries after she died. Hmm. So they're all hearsay, or they're adverting to other earlier written records which we no longer have access to. Plutarch, for example, talks sometimes about his great-grandfather and his grandfather and who lived during these times. But he didn't live during these times, so he is not an eyewitness to these events.
I see. Mary in Madison, hi.
Hello. Yes, I was wondering, the pharaohs are all depicted holding some object, and it has kind of a loop to it, or two objects. Could you go into the symbolism of that?
You mean the statues where they have their arms at their sides?
Yes.
Yeah, they're frequently shown, and the thing that, well, sometimes they hold an ankh, which has a true loop in it. You know, an ankh is a symbol of life. It's a hieroglyph for life or living. And you do see statues where they're holding the ankh by its loop. But there are also statues and depictions in two dimensions where they have their hands clenched at their sides, and they're holding something that seems to have a fold in it. It's usually defined as a folded cloth. It's something that just gives their hands something to do, to clench, because that's the pose that seemed to be the easiest to carve, or was the way to do it without having to splay all the fingers out. Sometimes, in two dimensions, they are shown with that same clenched pose, but they're holding a scepter, sort of, or a not a royal scepter necessarily, because it's not always royalty, but it's essentially a long rod that they hold. But in three-dimensional statuary, you can't have a big rod like that jutting out, because it would certainly break off. So they just, I think, replace it with something that just gives them something to clench. Usually it's called a folded cloth, but what its symbolism is, I just don't know.
Mm-hmm. Well, Carter, thank you so much. It was a pleasure to speak with you, and it's a terrific exhibit. And I would imagine you have one phenomenally interesting job.
Some days it's pretty better than others, but
right.
I love it, yeah.
Yeah, I'll bet. It sounds great. Thanks, Carter.
Thank you, Kathleen.
Yeah. Carter Lupton, our guest this hour of the program. He is Vice President of Programs, Department Head, and Curator of Ancient History at the Milwaukee Public Museum. And the exhibit, The World of Cleopatra the Seventh, and the exact title is Cleopatra, The Search for the Last Queen of Egypt. This will be at the museum until April 29. So you've got some time to stop by and see the 150 artifacts from her time, and also learn about the current efforts to find her tomb and Mark Antony's. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning and Chrissy Peace for production of this program. Thank you for listening to this program.